Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Kevin Reddington wanted to be back in court, well, today, as of this recording, Tuesday, to ask the judge to end the Lindsay Clancy case. If the judge refused, he wanted to start picking another jury the following Monday. That's what he initially wanted after they got the mistrial. It was, let's get right back to work. I gotta appreciate the work ethic in Kevin Reddington, without a doubt. All right, this one didn't work. Let's keep going. We have to wait, though, to discover what the DA is wanting to do. First, what are the possible paths forward here for Lindsay Clancy? We're going to get into all of that in this piece. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description or right below this video if you'd like to start commenting. So that was his request after Friday's mistrial. After weeks of testimony and 7 days of deliberations, he was ready to go again almost immediately. Kevin Reddington is no spring chicken, but my God, this guy's got the gusto and the willpower of someone half his age, putting it lightly. Judge William Sullivan slowed that timetable down. He talked about a possible trial later in the fall with schedules still to be worked out. So yes, another trial is a real possibility. And I understand the reaction. Are they seriously going to put this family through all of that again? Reddington is trying to get the prosecution stopped before that happens. District Attorney Tim Cruz has to decide whether his office will keep pursuing this as this goes forward. Cruz hasn't announced a decision to retry her yet. Clancy's three murder charges remain unresolved. You could hear how close Reddington believed he had come when he spoke about 11 jurors favoring acquittal. That's his account of the split. From his point of view, he persuaded almost the entire room. And one person had kept his client from being acquitted. Of course, he wanted to hang on to that jury. I mean, think about getting that close. Then having to explain to your client that you're still facing the possibility of starting all over again. We just went through this horrific multi-week experience in court of having to relive all of the worst moments of your life. And some of you are like, she deserves it. She should have to do that. And some of you are like, oh my God. The woman had a break from reality so severe that she thought it was a good idea to end the lives of her children. She's living in the horror reality of that as long as she breathes. She wants to be in an institution for the rest of her life because she knows she's not well. Why do we have to keep taking her out of the cage and poking her with sticks? What are we getting out of that? Are you teaching her a lesson? Don't kill your kids. We poke sticks at you. This'll teach the next one. Yeah, that always works. As you're about to fall into a fit of psychosis, you go, wait a second. I shouldn't get into that state of psychosis because the last time it happened to someone, it didn't work out so well, and her name was Lindsay Clancy. Let me stop my mind from deteriorating so much that I fall into that state of psychosis and do horrible things. Let me just put a roadblock up and stop that from happening. Oh, you can't do that? Oh, well, if you can't do that, then should we be handling this as if you can? As if it were a calculated choice on her part? Let's go back to the holdout. The complaint about the holdout deserved attention. The four-person reported that the juror had acknowledged doubt, but wasn't applying it to the verdict as the law required. Reddington wanted further questioning. Sullivan said the note didn't establish a refusal to follow the law and pointed out that the jurors had said they could follow his instructions. The defense's emergency request to the state's highest court failed, and the jury was then discharged. I would have wanted that concern examined carefully, too. Being the person who disagrees with everybody else doesn't automatically make you wrong. Refusing to follow the judge's instructions, though, would be another matter. Sullivan did not find that established here. Doesn't mean it wasn't happening. It just means the judge, within the confines of the note that he got back, didn't have that clearly established. We can question his handling of it without pretending we know everything that happened in that room. Now, Reddington wants Sullivan to look at whether the prosecution ever gave the jury enough evidence to convict. You'll hear this called a required finding of not guilty. That's the request he told the judge he wanted to argue. The judge has to ask, even taking the evidence at its strongest for the prosecution, could a reasonable jury find that the state proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt? A finding that the evidence was legally insufficient could end the prosecution on those charges. That would be a huge result for the defense without having to persuade another jury. That's a tough argument to win, though. Sullivan has to apply that standard even if he personally finds the defense persuasive. He can't just add his vote to the 11 Reddington described and call it an acquittal. Clancy's defense has acknowledged that she killed Cora Dawson and Callan. Her lawyers argue that postpartum psychosis left her without criminal responsibility. Prosecutors maintain she knowingly planned the killings. Her mental state at the time is the issue that would be fighting all over again. The prosecution had to prove she was responsible under the law beyond a reasonable doubt. So when someone asks why the defense didn't prove she was out of her mind, there's a problem with the question. The prosecution still has to prove its case. You can be horrified by what happened to these children and want a very hard look at whether that burden was actually met. For example, prosecutors called a pharmacy manager and a restaurant hostess who had spoken with Clancy by phone that day. Both said they noticed nothing unusual about those conversations, as if the restaurant manager and the pharmacy employee are supposed to somehow be experts on, you know, radaring psychosis through a phone call. Here's a fun little fact for you. Psychologists psychotherapists, experts in their actual field are probably not going to be able to necessarily pick that up over a quick phone call when somebody's asking about Miralax. So the weight of when you were on the phone with them that day and what they said and what you got back.
Well, they said that everything was fine. I don't know. I mean, I was putting away the combos and the Wheat Thins, and then I got a call, and she seemed fine.
So you're telling me she wasn't psychotic on the phone call?
No, I'm pretty sure she wasn't psychotic.
See, jury, the man who was putting away combos and Wheat Thins in aisle 7, who answered the question about Miralax, says she wasn't psychotic. Fact. Those observations are part of the prosecution's weak presentation. Reddington's request puts the strength of that whole case before the judge. Sullivan has to consider the evidence prosecutors actually offered and what a jury could reasonably conclude from it, not just you got a phone call about Miralax. If Sullivan turns Reddington down, the pressure moves to Cruz. The state, outside of the courthouse, he emphasized justice for the children. I understand why he brought the focus back to them. Gets a lot of attention. Gets a lot of people excited. You mentioned the kids. Wah! It is. It's like red meat to some people. I mean, it's sick. It's sick. I mean, I understand why he brought the focus back to them. It is ultimately about them, their deaths. They're the ones who paid for this hellscape. But how they got there is the question. And some are going to say, it doesn't matter how they got there. They're dead. To a certain extent, I do hear you. But in the interest of not repeating Lindsey Clancy's case over and over and over with different characters and different people every time, it might be in our best interest to try and understand this sort of illness or postpartum illnesses, depression, psychosis, and all the other myriad of fun that women have to go through after giving birth to children. Might be a little more in our best interest as human beings to try and understand that world rather than pretend it's full of witches and demons and people who just want to kill their children for fun. Because when you really look at it, it's not. There's sick people. There's hormones. There's chemicals moving in our bodies in ways we can't control and don't understand. And sometimes they move us into very unhealthy places that we ourselves do not have control over. And that's a scary thought. Without a doubt, that's a scary thought. But when that does happen, and it doesn't happen to everybody, but it does happen to some people, do we look at those people and go, well, that's your fault. That's your fault this happened to your body. That's your fault that you asked for help and there's nothing we could do to prevent this. It's still your fault and you need to burn for it. I mean, I get that if somebody's actively plotting and this is their plot in life of being a horrible human being, like, yeah, you can burn for that. But if this is not remotely how they've ever acted at any point in their life, and they've been begging for help and saying, I feel sick, I feel like there's something going on with my brain, and then the brain goes bad. It seems rather insane to look at that person and go, ha! See? Yeah, they've been telling you the whole time. It's not a see moment. So do we do that again? Do we do all of that again? My question for the state, for Cruz, it's pretty basic. After presenting this case once, what gives you confidence you can prove it to another jury? You know, you may believe the evidence already supports a conviction. A different jury could agree. Prosecutors don't need a dramatic new discovery, just to retry an unresolved case, and Reddington's account of an 11-1 split won't carry any votes in a second jury room. The next 12 would have to work through the evidence themselves, just as the last 12 did. Both sides would also have a chance to rethink how they tell the story. Perhaps a witness's explanation needs to be clearer. Perhaps a particular argument was less effective than the lawyer expected. We don't know what either side would change here, but they would be preparing with the benefit of having already seen each other's put on a full case. That alone makes a second trial a different experience to the attorneys. Could they work out an agreement and avoid another trial? That's possible, although there's no confirmed deal to report as of this moment. The defense has spent this trial seeking an acquittal on mental health grounds, so a guilty plea would be a major decision for Clancy. Prosecutors would have to decide what they could accept. Wanting to spare people another trial doesn't by itself give both sides terms they're willing to sign. Cruz could also decide against continuing the prosecution. He has that option. If he takes it, I'd want to hear his reasoning, too. These aren't three children's lives. Or these are three children's lives that we are talking about here. So what are we, what is the plan? What would you want to do? What happens to the questions about the care Clancy received? She and Patrick have separate civil cases against medical providers. Her civil attorney said after the mistrial that they intend to continue pursuing her lawsuits, which alleges failures in diagnosing and treating her mental illness. For anyone wondering whether the questions about her care disappear when the murder trial ends, those claims are still there. The lawsuits still have to establish that the providers were legally at fault, and they're going forward. Meanwhile, Clancy remains in custody at Tewksbury State Hospital. She wasn't released when the jury was dismissed. She's still waiting for the next decision while receiving care there. Even a future finding of not guilty because of mental illness wouldn't guarantee she goes home. Massachusetts has a process for examination and possible continued hospitalization after that kind of acquittal. The court would have to consider her present condition and the risk of serious harm. She could remain hospitalized if the legal requirements are met, or be released if there's no lawful basis to keep her. We can't put a number of years on that at this second. September 29th, though, is the next scheduled hearing. The court set it for discussion of where the case stands, possible trial scheduling, and Reddington's request for a finding of not guilty. His request for a hearing within days didn't become the court schedule. Sullivan mentioned a possible fall trial, but there's no fixed retrial start date yet to give you. We should get a clearer picture of how Reddington intends to argue that the case should end and what prosecutors want to do in the coming weeks. There may be more arguments and another date on the calendar before there's actually a final answer. So be careful about treating September 29th as the day that everything gets settled. It's not necessarily that. It's the next roll of the dice on the Candyland from Hell board. Patrick has already been through the process of telling a courtroom how he came home and discovered what had happened. His 911 call was played for the jury. He was out of the room while it played. Those are the kinds of moments that sit behind the ordinary sounding words of another trial. His attorney, David Miter, released a statement thanking the court and jurors for their work and perseverance. He called the prospect of reliving the tragedy through another trial extraordinarily painful. He also said there would never be closure for Patrick. People keep talking about closure as though he's a version of this, or there's some version of this where the court gets it right and a father gets to feel better. I mean, imagine being asked to prepare for those questions again. Let's talk about the trip out to dinner, coming home, discovering your children. Patrick already described those moments under oath. It's a hell of a thing to ask a father to go through that again. Although for so many people, in their minds, he did it. So there's no problem doing that. I mean, is that the audacity of this case? Is that part of the thinking of Patrick did it? Does that make it like acceptable then to put him on the stand? Because if you think he had something to do with it, then you're working at getting to the truth. You're not just re-victimizing someone all over again for your entertainment purposes. I don't know. I mean, that whole, I still am trying to really grasp the psychology on Patrick did it. Obviously, he did not do it. I'm talking about the theory and the mindset that so many people have on this, how they got there. That's a fun one. I mean, fun in a twisted sort of, you need serious help sort of way. The prosecutor makes the charging decisions. Patrick's statement doesn't decide the case. But he has said what another trial would cost him. Before this family is asked to go through another round, I want the people pursuing it to explain why exactly it needs to happen. Why were we here in the first place? And I don't want to hear, for the kids. Because that is completely ignoring the whole reason why we got here. It's completely ignoring the mental health aspect of all this and pretending that that is not the main factor of all of this. And I guess, I mean, the more we keep pretending it does not a thing, I guess the more we can keep moving on with our lives and pretending that this couldn't happen to someone you love, your daughter, your sister, your friends, whatever, somebody. If it's not a thing, it can't happen to you, right? I don't know. The distancing and gymnastics that have gone on in this case for people to digest the case in whatever way they're able to has been incredibly fascinating. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Well, we've all watched weeks of agonizing testimony end this last Friday, a stunning 11-1 deadlock, leaving everyone without closure. It's a pure emotional whiplash for the families and the public who followed every minute of the trial. And we're going to break it down. What happens next? We're going to break down the actual human mechanics of the hung jury and what dragging everyone through a second trial actually means. With us to do that, Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, and of course, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Well, as predicted, we had a holdout. We just watched the jury grind for 7 days, only to hang on the one single holdout who said, yeah, no, I think she's guilty, no matter what. According to Reddington, someone who was not following the instructions of the judge to the jury. That, I think, is where a lot of us kind of get lost, Bob. I mean, take us into that jury room. They're given instructions. The instructions here, you have to determine if she is not guilty by reason of insanity. And it's the state's job to prove it. In this case, it's not the other way around. And the jurors basically telling the judge, we don't think this one juror is following your instructions in that specific realm. The jury instructions also talk about following your convictions and what you think is right. I mean, it ends up being confusing, to say the least. After an hour of instructions, to expect everyone to walk out of that space and go, oh, I get it. I'm going to be perfect on this, I think is a bit of a task with hour-long instructions. How do you think this went down in that jury room now that we've had a weekend to kind of soak this all in?
Well, I think that to try to kind of understand it, and obviously we're speculating,
yeah.
But inside that room, I think that the first thing that we have to try to understand is that by day seven of the deliberations. In my estimation, nobody is arguing about evidence anymore, right?
Yeah.
They're arguing about each other. The 11 that have already walked the holdout through every exhibit, all the experts, every instruction. And then when that fails, you know, the room stops being about a deliberation and becomes kind of like a siege, you know, where it's 11 versus one. And, you know, the majority is cycling through, you know, persuasion, and they're frustrated and they're angry, they're exhausted. I mean, 40 hours of deliberation, or damn near 40 hours, is exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, you're coming in day after day, and you know, try to imagine being in it, and forget about sides in terms of which side is which side right now. Just imagine being 11 people on either side trying to convince one, and it's like smashing your head against a brick wall day after day after day after day. So you can imagine that would get very frustrating, right?
Yeah.
It would be exhausting. So ultimately, the foreperson in the case apparently sends the note telling the judge that the holdout, in the word that the judge used, the phrase is that the holdout acknowledged doubt but was refusing to apply the law as to reasonable doubt. And at that point, you know,
is that appropriate? That, right there. What refusing to apply the law to reach reasonable doubt? I think that's where a lot of confusion comes in and understanding, because we're talking about individuals who have convictions, which is another very loose term. I mean, applying the law to determine if there's reason. What if someone just says, fuck it, I don't care, she killed the kids?
Yeah, I mean,
that's their conviction. They're that is following the judge's instructions, but it's also not applying the law.
Right.
So at the same point, again, this is where it gets so muddy with the damn instructions and muddy with what are we expecting out of 12 human beings to really come up with here? We're wanting the human aspect of a person giving what their core beliefs are on something and applying it as a juror. But we're also saying you better follow this to a T, even if following it goes against your own conviction. I mean, we're asking them to basically become a computer to a certain extent while still maintaining their human abilities. Why don't we just have AI do it at this point? You might truly get what you're asking for then, because I don't think you're going to get it out of humans. I mean, let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, no, and look, we've been talking about, you know, the different types of jurors that could be on this case, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have the juror who I refer to as kind of the eye for an eye juror, you know, the person who's like, look, a mother who kills her three kids does not walk out, period. Mm-hmm. That person goes to prison.
Yeah.
There could be the person that's kind of where you're at, where there's a misunderstanding of the burden, treating reasonable doubt as any doubt, or in reverse, treating the Commonwealth's concession of mental illness, where,
yeah,
remember that part.
Like, it makes it even more confusing.
Right. At that point, everybody's like, okay, well, she definitely had a mental disease or defect. We're all in agreement to that.
Yeah.
At that point, what we're not in agreement about is whether or not that mental disease or defect caused Lindsay Clancy not to know right from wrong, or didn't allow her to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law, right? So, and that's a weird thing for people to try to understand.
It
is.
You
know what I mean? It's like, okay, wait, you know, because basically their last two witnesses landed in the Commonwealth, I'm talking about, landed on the concept that they went with bipolar 2. Like, that is what they said that she had.
Yeah.
And they both said, like, with bipolar 2, she still understood right from wrong, and she was able to conform her conduct, right? So you've got that kind of floating through this juror's head, potentially. And we don't know what this juror's thinking. We don't know if it's the eye for an eye juror. And the other part of it is we don't know exactly what the note says.
Yeah.
What we had was Judge Sullivan kind of paraphrasing, because it's Sullivan who says the jury's basically saying that the juror has acknowledged doubt but they're refusing to apply the law. That was like the sentence that he said.
Yeah.
Doubt is slippery.
Like, yeah.
He didn't use the word reasonable doubt. He just said the word doubt. So that leaves us out in the outside world kind of speculating, right?
So was it appropriate for Sullivan to paraphrase it that way? Because I keep doing all these different scenarios in my head, because I've learned so much from you, Bob, you know, especially on the defense side. You know, when I saw them deliberating long, I was like, wow, as Bob says, they're doing the hard work. This wasn't just a call it in thing. And this is actually watching the justice system at work in the state of Massachusetts, because many other states, this wouldn't be going on like this. And then the interpretation of what the law is, if that person believes they were acting lawfully, then they're acting lawfully. I mean, because it's kind of a subjective thing. But at the same time, there's a few things that had they not been done or said, would we be here? Like if they tried another state? And also, if Sullivan, Judge Sullivan, had not said that and merely said the jury came back again and said they couldn't all agree. I mean, in other words, what was compulsion to share? Because that's what really flamed things up even more. It's like throwing kerosene on the fire that he said, well, we have one holdout. Then everyone's jumped into conclusion, rightfully it looks like, including Reddington, that it's a holdout for the criminally insane. I was like, and so it seemed to exasperate a situation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, first of all, it is rare. I don't know that I've ever seen a four-person of a jury send out a note like that.
Yeah.
Essentially, like if the four-person is not the elected official of the, you know, a country. It's not an autocracy. It's you know, they're a person that is kind of in charge of going through the instructions and trying to keep some, you know, some modicum of control in there in terms of, all right, let's like everybody calm down. Let's try to ease it back a little bit. You know, they're trying to move the deliberations forward in a positive way if they can, you know, which is a tough gig back there.
Yeah.
You know, but for that juror that wrote the note, they didn't independently write it without talking with the other jurors, including the other juror, which was probably more like, look, I'm about to whistleblow on your ass. Like 11 of us are in agreement. I'm sending this note out. I'm telling the judge what's happening in here. And that's it. And the other juror was probably like, go for it. I don't care. You know what I mean? I mean, we know the holdout was holding out, because the other personality trait is that people harden under pressure. You know, if you're going to bristle up, it's 11 versus one and you're feeling cornered. I mean, you're going to protect yourself. I mean, it's human nature. I mean, we all do that, and you're going to get defensive. You know, which is a natural instinct. So,
should he have filtered that though?
Huh?
Should he have filtered that out then, Sullivan?
What I would have liked to have seen is just the actual note read verbatim. Like that. That's typically what you hear is a note being read verbatim. And the difference between us and the lawyers is the lawyers heard the note verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever Reddington's saying, and he's really
based on the note,
who
right?
spoke on the note. Because you have to understand, in this situation, this was an absolute Hail Mary touchdown catch for the Commonwealth, because they were on the verge of losing this trial.
Right.
Like they were thrilled. They were thrilled with the mistrial. This is a weird opposite effect, because in my estimation, it was a reverse jury nullification, wherein it was one particular juror that was refusing to from my estimation, follow the law, because I believe that the juror said, look, okay, you know, whatever, there's doubt, you know, maybe didn't even say, yeah, okay, I think there's a reason why. We have no idea what was going on, what was being said over 7 days, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But at some point, there's some acknowledgement by that person that yeah, okay, there's some kind of doubt. I don't care. You know, like, she killed her kids. She's going to prison. That's like, you're never getting me to change my vote. That's that. So we can talk about this for 100 years and I'm never changing my mind. The problem with that is that person, before they were selected as a juror, was asked if they could put that aside. Mm-hmm. If you put your personal biases and your feelings and your convictions. And if your answer to that is no, that's totally fair.
And then you're not on the jury.
Allowable.
Yeah.
But you have to be honest about it.
Yeah.
And you have to tell the judge, I'm sorry, Judge. I feel so strongly about this that there is no circumstance under which I am going to ever change my opinion on that. I honestly don't care what the evidence. There is no shame in that.
And they could also have done it, though. But they also could have done it. I mean, few of us, if any of us, have seen and heard such horrendous things as they saw during that case. And so you could easily come in with thinking you have a very open mind until you witness the things they did, like the 9/11, you know, the 911 call, which was horrific. Again, just from what we heard. And it would make you it would make you more, you know, convicted in there. And this isn't the first case that things like this has happened on either. So it just, again, it's imperfect solutions to an imperfect system, but it's still a system. So it's a tough situation.
Yeah, and that's what I've said. You know, like that juror could have been asked that question at the point, because every juror's asked that question.
Yeah.
Every juror that indicates that there might be some kind of bias, that they have an opinion on it coming in, is asked that question. Well, okay, it's how you rehabilitate jurors. You know, I always hate it as a defense attorney. I'm like, they're not changing their mind. It's like, right. I know, you know, and the judge is like, because then that we were talking about this last week, that's the point where I have to get rid of a juror for, you know, using one of my challenges, my peremptory challenges. I have to say, okay, well, they should have been booted for cause, because you and I both know that's bullshit. That person's never changing their mind because they're human. You know, so that question's asked. But to your point, Robin, it's very likely that juror wasn't lying on the front end.
Yeah.
The juror probably said, well, yeah, I can apply the law despite what he feels. And then, like you said, as the evidence starts coming in, he realizes midway through, like, man, there's no way.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to be able to do this. It's like, I feel the way I feel. My convictions are what they are. My morality is what it is. And I'm not going to be able to change my mind on that. And then what's that juror supposed to do at that point? You know what I'm saying? Like the train has left the station.
Yeah.
You know, and the other part of this that's really, you know, problematic is that we get the Tui Rodriguez charge, all right, or the dynamite charge, or the Allen charge. They call it different things in different jurisdictions. But that essentially tells, and there's the language in that, tells the jurors in the minority to re-examine their views, but it also tells them not to surrender an honest conviction just to reach a verdict.
Right.
So that language exists in the Tui Rodriguez charge, which is the last charge that went back. So when that juror is hearing that, like that exact language, you know, not to surrender an honest conviction just to reach a verdict, Sullivan reads it. And then the jury
there's that's your personal confirmation bias. You hear what you want to hear to double down on what you're already thinking.
Yeah.
It's like a dog and pony show that we present, and we think, oh, this will all work out well. These people will follow these rules and this Tui Rodriguez charge. This will get them. At the end of the day, there really are no consequences to a juror not following the instructions. It's pretty much it's the honor system.
But in their mind, they did. You know,
in their mind, you're exactly right. And somebody early on here in this, you know, there's a lot of ways you can think about it. You can think about it. Well, they went in and they knew that they were going to do this. Maybe not. Like you were saying, maybe they went in thinking, I will be very unbiased. Right. And maybe the evidence hit them in such a way they're like, shit, no. Bitch is going down. If that's that's how they're thinking, and that's their conviction. That's truly what they believe, and that's not them necessarily going in thinking I'm going to convict her no matter what. That's them seeing the evidence and further being fortified into their own position. Mm-hmm. At the end, I mean, and then everybody goes into the world of, well, what if this juror had, you know, what if they came into it knowing they're going to hang it, and they were. Okay, there's that argument, and that certainly can happen. I'm not saying it happened here. I don't know if it happened here, but that can certainly happen. But Bob, does a consequence exist for someone who goes into a trial with the ill intent? Not the my opinion changed or further fortified this way or that way. One that went in, lied to the attorneys, lied to the judge going in that they could be unbiased, knowing full damn well I'm going to convict her. I don't care what the hell you present to me in the next handful of weeks. This is what I'm going to be. Is there any consequence for that if that could ever be proven? Like if it's like, yep, they said it going in. Here they are on video saying exactly that. I'm not saying they are.
Not that I'm aware of.
No, it's just like, Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
shame on the attorneys for not catching that person that basically got through the cracks, basically.
Right. You know, because, yeah. I mean, if you go all the way back to the OJ jury,
yeah.
You know, when it came out after the fact, long after the fact, you know, when we've seen some of the documentaries that were made and they got some of the jurors on there and they're like, this was an eye for an eye for us as black people because the Rodney King verdict had come down for the cops who had beaten the shit out of him on the side of the road and they were all acquitted. Like this was us literally saying, okay, how you like it? We're doing, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I don't remember hearing anything happening to those jurors. You know,
right.
I don't know what you do in that situation. I mean, if I were the holdout juror, you know, I mean, your solution to that is to simply say, I my understanding of reasonable doubt is that the Commonwealth met its burden. You know, they proved it beyond a reasonable doubt to me that she didn't have psychosis. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the easiest thing for that person to say. But then again, like, we don't know what the note says verbatim. That's where the whole thing here is. Yeah. You know, it's like, maybe it says exactly that. Maybe it just uses the word doubt, you know, sure. And maybe the other 11 are misconstrued. It's a situation we're in. We can't get into the providence of the providence of the deliberations has to be sacred,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. which is ultimately why Sullivan's like, and I disagreed with them. I think that there was probably a very generic answer or a question rather that he could have asked that wouldn't have gotten into the providence of the jury deliberations because you can't have a judge inserting himself in there. You sure. can't have a judge asking specifics about what they're deliberating about. Like, okay, well, let me, what is your understanding of reasonable doubt? And like, let me tell you what it means. Like that can't happen.
Right.
That can never happen with the jury. You know, they're given the instructions. They've been agreed upon by both sides. Both sides send them back and the judge sends them back and that's it. And there is no explaining the law. We say whatever the law that has been given to you that you are to apply is in your hands. You need to go back. Yeah. You need to read it again, and you need to apply it as you see fit.
But is this one of the reasons why also? Because, you know, I don't think I've ever followed a case this closely with so many what-ifs going through my mind with deep analysis, not just on the loss of the three children and what caused it in Lindsay and whether I believe in the psychosis or not psychosis, but all these things. And to come back with a jury finding like this with one person holding out, is this one of the reasons why we have an appeals process? Because it is an imperfect system? Or is that a wholly different thing?
It's a wholly different thing. I mean, this isn't really... I think there's going to be a filing in this case mm-hmm. by the appellate counsel, probably the same one who did the 211-3 petition to try to stay this. In order to try to force the judge into having that individual voir dire with that one particular juror, as you saw, the SJC turned around pretty quickly and said, no, we don't see it here. And I'm assuming if the note would have been any more particular as to what was said, then they might have come back a different way. So, because we read that petition on the air, like when that whole thing when it was happening was insane. Like it was happening so fast, it was completely out of left field. Even though Allie and I were screaming on our live that they need to file that thing, and then Red all of a sudden does it, and you know, and he had been talking to, like after I think it was probably right after Tui was sent back, and then I think at that point he probably reached out to the appellate lawyer and said, look, you know, you need to prepare this petition because I have a feeling this thing's going to come back hung, like this juror's just not budging, and I want the judge to question this juror. And generically, though, again, it has to be generic,
right?
You know, it has to be like a question, like that same question that was asked in the beginning, not getting into the details of the deliberations, but just saying, you know, are you able to put aside your bias or your opinion and follow the law? Because the law is, if you find that the Commonwealth has not met their burden beyond a reasonable doubt, and they use that moral certainty language in Mass, which right. is it's lofty language.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's way loftier language than we have in Illinois. You know, moral certainty is pretty intense. So, you know, and just ask that generically. And, you know, if the juror at that point, if they're one of those folks that in good faith said, yeah, I'll be able to put my bias or my opinion or my convictions aside and follow the law on the front end. But like you said, Robin, he hears the plaintiff wails of Patrick Clancy when he discovers his kids and he's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to do this.
Right.
You know,
it's a human reaction. Yeah.
That's
it's very reasonable.
It's a human reaction. Yeah. And it's only going to bolster the way that person's feeling coming in. Anyway, yeah.
You know, very much. So your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation about the Lindsey Clancy lack of verdict.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.